Okay, today is December 1st, 2014. For me, this is the confusing time of year when it's 2014 and 5775. So, like, you know, is it 2015 yet? Okay, 21 more month of 2014. And we're going to do four mitzvahs today because they're kind of related, although one's jumping ahead, but the in-between ones have so much in them that we have to do them separately. So 427, so I'll just read them through first. 427, to form no marital bonds with idol worshippers, so no intermarriage. 428, not to derive benefit from any ornamentation of an idol. 429, not to take any object from idolatry into our possession to derive benefit from it. And 436, the precept to destroy an idol and all that serves it. Okay, so this is all idol worship stuff, as you see. See, none of you were here last week, right? Of the
four. No, Ellie said only she.
Right, and Esther. Right. Yeah, too bad. Yeah, because last week I spoke a little. I just speak a little bit about Rabbi Kalman Levine, the boss of my husband. So, he was a masmid, has the word tamid in it. So he learned. That was his life. He was a real tzaddik. So I'll just say, look, two things. I mean, so many times we've heard people have fallen asleep over their books. He did regularly. So he slept about 4 hours a night regularly. He would fall asleep on his books, and his kids would wake him up, and he would, you know, learn a little bit more, and he'd fall, and somebody else would wake him up, and he'd sleep like about 4 hours. And then he would get up for the first prayer of the morning, not Shacharit, the regular one that normal people go to at 6 or 7 a.m., but the first time you could say it. That's called davening nates. As soon as the sun comes up, it's time to that initial sunrise, so that you actually start a little bit before, but you get to Shema at exactly the first time you could say it, and Shemona Esrei at exactly the first time you could say it. So that's called davening nates, netzachama, from the spark of the sun. So he davened nates every day. But he was actually raised in Kansas City. He was a Baal Tshuva at a young age. I was there at the Shiva when his Rebbe from Kansas City, the one who gave him his tzitzis, came. He had made Aliyah, and he was there. So he davened nates, but he was always, on the one hand, you would say always a Baal Tshuva. Like, he cared so much. Oh, he never got jaded. So his Shemona Esrei, his Amida prayer was so long every day that he missed the rest of the tefillah. He'd say Shemona Esrei for so long that everybody else was finished, wrap up, close up shop, and go home. He would go to a second minyan for the rest of the davening on a regular basis. This is not like once in a while. That's who he was, right? That's the kind of guy he was. Yeah, he was one of the four who was killed, yeah. So he was 55, nine kids. The youngest is 10, yeah. So his wife was very clear, and it's interesting, I didn't even get to listen to all the recordings and everything, but I was there, but I just listened to a little bit of one of the things she said after Shiva, but she said, I want to make it clear, we are not victims of terror. This is Hashem that did this. This is how the world works. There's a shift in energies. We are not victims of terror. We are part of Hashem's plan in this world. Everybody needs to know, this is what Hashem decided. Clearly these four were chosen. There's not a question about it. And we all have to strengthen our prayer, strengthen our kindness, strengthen our togetherness. We need to reach out and understand Hashem runs the world, and Hashem ran this too. And we need to come together. Oh my gosh.
I don't even know how you get there.
Right?
I don't know how you get there.
She's very clear about it. It was amazing. I'm so glad I went to pay a Shiva call, because it was really a very holy Shiva. Very holy. In a way, it reminded me of Elisheva and Yoshua's wedding. You were there, right? It was a very holy experience on the positive side. This was like had that level of kedusha. Like, everybody felt something really special there, but from the negative, like from the sorrow of it. But it felt very different than a regular Shiva. Like, you walked in, it was clearly holy.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really something. So, and just to see, like, I mean, of course there's 10, you know, 9 kids who have to take, there's 26 orphans who have to take in the whole thing, but so I guess this is the starting to take in time, because there in Israel, they bury so fast, you know,
right.
they're buried, like, before they were cold, really, you know, like, they're in the ground very fast, same day, they were, and within, like, 6 hours, everything was done, you know, I mean, very fast. So maybe 8 hours, but really.
Very fast.
I mean, they start.
To me, it's like so fast that it's
you can't take it in.
That they're not there
right.
anymore.
Right.
You know, it's not like you even have. I mean, 20 people think 24 hours is short, but I mean, we're right. used to it. But you can't even absorb.
Right. There's
when something happens so suddenly.
Right. No, you can't.
You know, 1 minute they're there, right. the next minute they're.
They're not. The next minute they're in the ground. Right.
Not just not there, but in the ground.
Right. 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 So.
When I saw some of the photos, and there, unfortunately, it was a mess, and there was blood on, like, prayer books and things like that. Can the family have their items back? Or is
no.
That,
no. All that gets buried. Everything
okay.
with, because the blood, the blood that comes out after death, during death, the blood that was there, like, mm-hmm. is part of the body. It has to get buried.
Okay.
So in a car accident, they even rip up the seats. You know, they take all the fabric, anything that blood got on goes in the coffin with the body.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
So, yeah.
Well, but do they do a coffin even, or do they just do the?
But everything goes with the body.
Rabbi Wagner
right.
was buried. It was
right. They just did
a
shroud. Yeah, they often don't do a box in Israel.
Yeah.
You're right. But everything gets buried with
the person.
The mace. Yeah, with the body. Yeah, so Rabbi Levine, Alav HaShalom, my boss's husband, so his was the only tefillin of the four where the boxes did not have blood.
Oh, did not.
Yeah, the straps did, but the boxes
so
didn't.
So
they
off.
Did cut the straps off and gave the boxes
sure
to one of his sons who carried them around like a teddy bear the whole
oh
time.
My gosh.
Yeah, they were in a tefillin bag and he just walked around like this the whole time hugging them. Yeah, yeah, it was very sad. So anyway, so he learned, and part of what he was learning so much in the last time period was the justice of Hashem's decrees, Tziduk Hadin. Yeah, that's what he was learning, and that's what he was teaching in his learning groups. And Chaya, my boss, Chaya Levine, said she's so amazing, at the Shabbat, she's like, you could see the chesed of Hashem in the whole thing. You know, that my husband was learning this and he was able to prepare himself and able to prepare us. And she said, and even the fact that, you know, I went to this WIC conference where she was there. She said, and right before that, she came from Israel for that, but she went out to California to that couple that they have the 2-year-old baby that drowned but didn't die, who's been in the coma for the last 4 months. So she went there. And there she also had prepared and gave a class on accepting Hashem's decrees and dealing with hard times. And so she said, and look, he even helped me prepare this class so that I would be ready to accept it. You know, and so like, yeah. So she sees that as God's kindness, and she's very clear. So, Hashem should give her strength. There's feeling that way and also feeling the loss, and look, that it's going to take time, you know, over the course of the next few years to digest the whole thing. And I haven't spoken to her since I came back from Shiva. I tried calling last week, and somebody else answered the phone and said, call back this week, so I'll call again, hopefully today. But, and I don't know what's going to do. I mean, she traveled for work. Her youngest is 10. She's probably going to have to wait a few years before she travels again. So we'll see what happens, but yeah. Whole big thing. So that being said, and I'll bring this back into here to form no marital bonds with idol worshippers. So why not? Because marriage forms strong bonds. So she said, even though she was raised, her parents are Holocaust survivors in Shomer Shabbos, and she was raised in Cleveland. And she became stronger through NCSY back in the day when NCSY was a real force. But she was raised Shomer Shabbos, so she always was. And here she marries this Baal Teshuva from Kansas City whose parents look knew nothing, really. Still know very little, but
Are alive?
Yeah, his parents are alive. Mm-hmm. His sister actually lives in Boulder. I want to contact his sister.
Yes,
yeah.
I saw that online. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Right, I read that.
Yeah, yeah. So, but Chaya told me that everything she is from him, that he's the one who learned so much and built so much. And here she was raised in the Shomer Shabbos house and had day school education, and she would like to read from English books or whatever, like learn from English books. And he was like, absolutely not. You have the skills. Let's go. Hebrew. You need to be learning in Hebrew. You need to be looking at the sources. I'm going to sit with you. I'm going to make sure you have it. And he built her over the years that she learns in Hebrew from the original. And And she just feels like, how am I going to do what I'm supposed to do? Because everything I am is from him. And he was so careful. Like every bracha, I was in that house many times and heard him make brachas. And he didn't just say, you know, with kavana, shakal ni abed baruch. He was like, Baruch, Ata, Hashem. Every bracha. Every bracha.
That's your whole life. I mean,
that's yeah, that was his whole life, really. That was it. She's the principal income. He's a supplementary, but his job is called Shoel Umeshiv, the question answerer in the Beis Medrash. Mm-hmm. So his job is to sit in the Beis Medrash and learn and answer people's questions. So kind of in a way like the librarian, you know, like where do you find this and how do you understand that and how can I look this up? That was his job. So, okay, so so that's what marriage can get you or take you away from. So, Lahavdil, so to form no marital bonds with idol worshippers, that's Mitzvah 427. So this is a very interesting thing because we are talking about idolatry here. So that we should not intermarry with the nations. This is specifically speaking about the seven nations and all the nations. Okay, so what does that mean? Why say the seven nations? So the seven nations that are the nations that existed in the land of Israel when the Jews first came into the land of Israel, they are considered to be the root, the core of idolatry in the world. Mm-hmm. They represent it. They're the strong ones. So how do you say don't intermarry with idol worshippers, them, or in these specific seven? So what?
Or any others.
Mm-hmm. Right, or any others. So what we're saying is, what it's saying is, you can't marry with anybody who's not Jewish, and not even these seven nations, even if they convert. They can convert, but you can't intermarry with them. There is no intermarriage with them, period. There are other nations that can convert, and you can intermarry. A regular convert you can intermarry with. There are a few different nations, I think Egypt is one of them, that you can only intermarry after the third generation, but you can eventually, but not that fresh convert, but after they've... Let's say after a couple of Egyptian converts married each other and had a generation and then another generation, then you can marry their kids. But these seven nations, you can't.
So from a different nation, you could if they converted with the limitations that you spoke about potentially. But from the seven nations...
Never. You can't marry them.
Why is that?
Right. Why is that? So it's interesting. So... and what happens, like, we don't know today, like, who is who? So we don't hold by this today. We do intermarry with converts. I'm not sure what would happen if an Egyptian converts and if they're considered the ancient Egyptian, and I think it is three generations for Egyptians. So why is that? So let me just start back with the other nations that you have to wait the three generations. So, and let me just start back with the ones that you can just marry, okay?
Okay.
So when I first was in Israel and was not quite old enough to date, because I moved to Israel at 16, right? So 17, 18, but I was with all older girls who were dating. So, and some guys, you know, would occasionally, you know, we weren't the Shomer Shabbos and Kashrus, but like not talking
totally
to boys,
right?
So we would sometimes have guys over for a Shabbos lunch. And I remember one of them said, my mother would never let me date a convert. And I thought, why not? Like, how bad is that? What's wrong with that? That's not very nice, you know, like a convert who...
Especially given your situation.
Right. So that really, it surprised me. Okay, so that, I like took that and it bothered me for years until I had grown-up children who were ready to date. And then I realized, having lived my life, you marry a convert, you marry their family.
Right.
You do. You get non-Jewish grandparents when you marry a convert. Even if the convert's 100% sincere, there's non-Jewish grandparents, there's non-Jewish cousins. And not only that, but the convert comes with whatever baggage she has or he has, right? Okay, well, it's one thing if they converted as a teen. Even if they converted as a teen, they still have little bits and pieces. They still have the whole family. Even if they're an orphan that converted as a teen, they still have some past, right? And they still, even if they don't have a past, even if they were raised by wolves... And then they converted as a teen, so this is the only religion they ever knew and the only society they ever knew. They still don't have roots, right? So they still aren't deeply anchored into the Jewish people. Even those Jews who are not observant are still very anchored, you know, and they still really get being Jewish and the Jewish fears and the Jewish hopes and the Jewish aspirations and the Jewish responsibility in ways that a convert doesn't have. So that's a convert you're allowed to marry, right? Right away, as soon as they convert and they're sincere. Right now, let's pick somebody from a nation who, let's just take Egypt, of today, you know, for generations, they've inculcated hatred against Jews.
So there's some spark of that in the person, no matter what.
There probably is something that needs to just be worked out. It takes a few generations. You know, so they do say it takes three generations to fully blend. So my kids are raised by me, and they still have eclectic, weird things. They've camped. They've owned pets. Whatever it is.
To your mother,
they've been exposed
however,
to my mother. They've right.
Open and supportive. And
right. So it's going to be a Huvanava, that third generation, who can blend more seamlessly, raised by FFBs with Jewish grandparents, with the Seders, with grandparents at the Seder, with the parents not trying to make their own way in the world, right? Then she's raised in much more of a, so that's a very different kind of a person than the children of even Baalei Tshuva. You know, you meet a lot of FFBs who will say, oh, my parents are Baal Tshuvas. So when you say my parents are Baal Tshuvas, that means you're a different kind of FFB. You just are, because your parents have FFB from birth. So an FFB, yeah, FFB, from birth. So an FFB who's the child of BTs, Baal Tshuvas, they are different than FFBs who are the children of FFBs.
Like you're talking in a text message.
You know, it's very interesting though, because my parents were not observant at all, not the least bit observant. But my father was raised in a very Orthodox, very observant family. And they moved to Israel, you know. But there was something so quintessently Jewish about him. It didn't matter. When I say it didn't matter, I mean in the context.
Right.
That he
For him,
didn't
it didn't.
Necessarily
That's true.
Observe or follow or because that's just who he was.
He was so Jewish
it's
in his guts.
That's just who he was.
That generation was over.
Yeah. That's just who, I mean, it was like inside of him.
So in the olden days, they used the word Yiddishkeit to refer to Jewish, not to Judaism. Today, they talk about Yiddishkeit, and they mean Judaism when they say that. But in the 40s and 50s, maybe even in the 60s, maybe even in the 70s, when they said Yiddishkeit, they meant Jewishness. They meant lox and bagels. They meant kishka. They meant guys with chais and cigars. They meant the borscht belt. That was Yiddishkeit. Speaking Yiddish, Yiddish theater, completely divorced from Judaism, but it was so Jewish. So Jewish.
The humor, I mean,
so
everything,
Jewish.
Everything.
Right. We don't have that today. We don't have 20-year-olds today who are so Jewish.
You're sort of in the middle.
You're in the middle, yes, you are, yeah. Because it's your parents' generation that were so Jewish in their guts and they couldn't leave it. You're already of a generation, you're just on the edge. I would say the 70s and ups are still just there where it's Jewish in their kishkas and they can't get it out. And below that, there's really like you're in choice about it, whether you feel like being Jewish or not. And I'd say the 40s and belows have to actually work to achieve a Jewish identity. Because the 40s and belows
ages.
Today, yeah, the 40s and belows of today, and it's going to move up because those 40s will turn into 70s. They might not feel Jewish at all whatsoever. Whereas your generations could, like some do and some don't. I'm sure you have some friends who don't feel that Jewish at all, and some who feel much stronger, right? But the today's 30-year-olds, most don't. 30s and below, and most college students.
See, it's interesting. I can't remember where I was, but we were at a lecture or something, and they were saying the real thing, the total thing we need to focus on is the colleges.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, above all.
But why is that? That's because that's the future, right? I mean, so the 40-year-olds
are
already lost.
Those are the people that are so divorced.
So
emotionally.
Divorced, right.
I mean, it's an emotional divorce as much as an intellectual divorce.
It's a kishka divorce. That's what I'm saying. It's not even emotional or intellectual. That's
it's just inside.
It's the kishkas aren't even there. Like, ask Rivka. She's on campus. What do you see?
I'd rather not say
that. It's too hard.
Right? It's, what, I mean...
Well, I think it's an emotional divorce, and it's also a very strong antipathy. I mean, it's not just divorce. It is revulsion towards Jewishness, Yiddishkeit, Jewish affiliation.
Right. It's so strong.
So it's
right?
more than just nothing.
Nothing
it's,
like
it's
it. Right.
Negative. It's
that's
aversion.
What I'm,
it's
that's what I'm saying. It's in the kishkas. It's not in the kishkas. And since it's not in the kishkas at all, that's why you can get to a revulsion. Because you couldn't. You know, I mean, I saw that so strongly when I went to see that movie on J Street at the Chez Artiste, right? So here's I was looking at the audience, right? Everybody's 50 plus except for maybe four people, maybe. So there was one couple who was in their 30s, a couple. I think there was one person in the entire room who was in his 20s. I asked
him.
And
it should be ideally
the opposite way.
Right. So I was thinking, all of us in this room were activists in college.
Yeah.
And
totally.
That's who's left.
Totally.
Not our kids. None of our kids were there. Nobody's kids were there. There were no 20-year-olds in the room. There were no college kids.
Well, you know what? And I think that's not just true of J Street or, you know, I mean, almost anything
I'm saying
that
Israel
you go
concern.
To that's related to Israel or Jewish.
No, that's what I mean.
Content.
It doesn't mean, not
almost
J Street.
Anything.
I'm just saying there's
anything.
Nobody. There's nothing, right? So what I'm saying is that there, the people who were activists are now 50. Those are the ones who were on college campuses. They were crusading for Soviet Jewry. They were whatever it was, for civil rights, whatever it was. They were, today's kids, what are they doing?
Exactly. You know, you go to a symphony concert, you see people in the 50s and all. Mm-hmm. You don't see 20s or 30s, you know. You don't.
I don't know where they go.
And they hang out on social media.
Probably at home.
Which is sort of by yourself.
Experience.
I mean, it's sort of by yourself.
It's a whole different world. It's actually a whole different world that we're living in. It's really fascinating. The world is really shifting in such
a
major way.
So
it's very difficult to understand. We're actually living in parallel universes.
Mm-hmm.
We really are. Because we live in a world of friendships and facial contact and like understanding things that they don't understand and we don't understand. This is not a generation gap.
We don't understand that they don't understand.
This is not even a generation gap, right. Mm-hmm. We don't even understand how the other person doesn't understand because it's so vastly different. So there are a few bridges to translate a little bit, like, you know, maybe some college professors or people like that, you know, people who work on campus. But really, it's such different worlds, it's hard to even imagine the other person's world. Yeah, it's
the term being alone together.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, and that's what people are. It's really mm-hmm. amazing. Yeah. So that's interesting just
to
see. So
just hang out and everybody's on their device.
Any cafe. Cafes used to be all about sociability.
Right. It's interesting. I just got a knock on the door last night. I'm excited about this. Well, I hope it works. There's a Jewish guy in our neighborhood, not from, married to a Jew. He's 27. He's going to be opening a cafe called Gathering Grounds. It's a board game cafe.
Great idea.
Fun.
Wow.
And,
coffee.
And coffee, tea,
and
board games, and snacky foods. And he wants to get a liquor license. That's why he's trying to get,
mm-hmm.
just make it some beers on tap and some wine, not a bar. It's
not
a bar,
but
just make it easier.
Sort of a little.
Yeah. So I said, I totally support you. I think it's terrific. He wants it to be kosher. I said, that's great. I said, but let me just tell you, in our neighborhood, the Jews who live here, they don't have money and they don't like to have fun. So don't worry about that.
And they don't like to have fun.
They don't like to have fun.
They don't.
I think
but
they
fun in that way.
Fun in
but
it.
I'm saying they, fun for them is learning and right. not going to play a board game in a cafe.
Which is a waste of time.
Right.
Oh.
So I don't think, I said, he's going to also open one in Greenwood Village. I said, great, they have
That's
money
it.
And they have fun, so that will be successful, kosher there. And one Hilltop, he's thinking about Hilltop. I said, great, this neighborhood too,
right.
fun
yeah,
and
yeah,
money.
Yeah.
You have both. It will work here. I said, but on the west side, I said, if you end up giving up kosher, like I wanted to be kosher, it'd be lovely, but it costs money. So like, don't like be married to it here in our location.
Because
it's going to cost so much money. I want your business
there.
To be successful.
Right.
You know,
the people
like,
that care about it aren't going to be there.
Right. The people, right. So, right, but so the idea is board games, contact, talking to people,
mm-hmm.
being in a place where you're not on social media, you're not playing a game here, you're playing a game here. Like,
and so you have to interact.
Right. I think that's fascinating. I think it's a great idea. We need ways for people to talk to each other. Okay, so now we're talking about the people, converts that you can marry right away, converts that you can only marry after three generations, and those that you can't at all. So that's what this is saying, no marital bonds. Why? Because they bring stuff to the table that we don't want at the table. We can't integrate into Judaism. So we can't have people who are bringing that negativity into Judaism.
Elisa, yeah. I was looking at what you discussed last week, and I wasn't here, and the Rambam says, well, you know, even though we don't understand, this is on page 297, Mitzvah 425,
mm-hmm.
Rambam says, even though we don't know who the seven nations are, it still is in force in all generations. But then that's really confusing because
right.
if even at that time he was not sure who those seven nations had become, how do we apply that?
Right, so that would be the halacha lamaaseh. What do we do today? So we clearly see halacha lamaaseh is we marry converts. And we don't really ask their origin.
And we don't identify we don't, from being...
We don't know who they are.
We don't know who they are.
We don't know who they are. So I'm just curious if, like, I think with the Egyptian thing, does that count today? Or does it? Does the do the people who live in Egypt count as the Egyptians even? They might not halakhically count as that. Right. So I'm just using that as an example that we can see that somebody who's been inculcated, somebody who watched, you know, Egyptian Sesame Street or Palestinian Sesame Street, you know, with the Mickey Mouse that says kill the Jews all the time, you know, they were raised on that. And then they converted. So you just don't want, like, even though they're a true Jew, but should they be marrying? Like, it's maybe not what you want until a couple of generations pass when that's kind of, when that's been cleaned out through the generations. But halakhically, we marry today. So if we could prove the lineage, maybe we would say you can't marry that person, but we don't know.
We can't.
So you would think, because this is an Isur D'oraisa, and since this is a biblical prohibition, Isur prohibition, D'oraisa, biblical, and the rule is with biblical prohibitions, you go strict, not lenient. With rabbinic prohibitions, you go lenient, if you're not sure, whenever you're not sure, right? So let's say we're going to find out next week, but when we talk about making blessings on food, so it's biblical to bless after and rabbinic to bless before. So if you're in the middle of eating your apple and you say, oh, did I make a bracha on this or not? Now you have a question mark. No, you do not re-say the blessing because you go lenient if it's rabbinic. But afterwards, now not apples, but your sandwich, right? After your sandwich where it's biblical to bench after you have bread and now you're driving away from your meeting and you're thinking, did I bench or not? You have to re-bench because it's biblical. So here it's biblical, and you might think, oh, we have to go strict. No marrying any converts at all whatsoever, right? You might think that, but that's not actually how we rule. So we do marry converts today. So, and I'm not sure why. I'm not sure how I got there. I'll try to find that out. Like, how did we get to the place where that's actually...
It has to work.
Pardon?
I mean, we have to work.
It has to work.
It has to work. We have to subsist.
Right.
We have to continue.
Right.
We have
so
to
how's
survive.
That going to work? Right. So how's that going to function? Right.
Yeah.
So let's just talk about marriage for a second. You can't marry. It's not that you may not. This mitzvah is you may not marry, right? Somebody. But the halacha is you can't marry somebody. Meaning you cannot effect a marriage between a Jew and a non-Jew. A Jew and a non-Jew get married. It's not a marriage.
Oh, I see.
So they're not married. It's like a brother and a sister get married. They're not married. Right. They're just not. So what does this mean even then? If you can't marry them, why say you may not marry them? So what this is referring to is anything that looks like a marriage. So a civil marriage, a religious marriage of another religion, that where the couple is making a decision, having a ceremony, saying we're married, or even a decision. Let's move in together. They have that conversation, they move in together, they start living like husband and wife. Maybe they're not mixing all their finances even, but they're living together. That's transgressing this. That is the prohibition. Living like you're married, whether it's with a ceremony that precedes it or a decision that precedes it. This is not referring to a one-night hookup, right? That's a separate prohibition. It's its own thing, and likely rabbinic and not biblical. So the sleeping around in college that people do, whatever, that's a different prohibition than this. It's forbidden, but it's a different prohibition than this. This is moving in together, living as if you're married, even though you can't actually be married. There's no divorce proceedings from this. Even if somebody has a civil marriage that binds them legally, and they do a religious marriage of another religion, and they say till death do us part.
But they're not married.
They're not married. So if one of them is Jewish, they don't have to do anything to divorce that person. Religiously. Yeah. They can just walk away and they're no longer married to them. Excuse me, no longer in that state. Because they can't be married. So there's nothing that can bind you, but you can't act as if you're bound. That's what this is. You're not permitted to do that. This is in effect everywhere at every time for both male and female. Right? If a person violated this and intermarried with the seven nations, even in their state of conversion to Judaism, in other words, he selected a wife for himself from among them, he was conjugally intimate with her, those two things, he should be given whiplashes. If someone selected a wife from among them for his son, or he gave his daughter to one of them in marriage, the father would violate this negative precept, but he would not receive whiplashes, since he didn't have that physical action. However, the son who performed the act of conjugal intimacy would receive lashes. As to other peoples, and so too the seven nations within their heathen state, if somebody selected a wife for himself from among them to be conjugally intimate with her regularly, he would receive a whipping by Torah law upon the first act of conjugal intimacy, since he singled her out for his mate, while she should be put to death.
Ooh, wow.
If, however, he did not choose her for a spouse, but was rather intimate with her by way of immorality, he should be whipped with lashes of disobedience by the ruling of the sages. So if it was just what they call a mice's noose, if it was just a hookup, if it was just, a hookup is a nice way of saying, just an act of prostitution, with or without money, right? But just an act of immorality, so you just get whipped for it. But she, it's interesting.
She gets put to death.
Yeah.
So it's
she gets put to death if they marry.
Oh, okay.
Not if they, if it's oh, just so a hookup, she does not.
Mate. Okay. So it's interesting that they, at that time, felt that there was authority to punish the heathen spouse.
Well, so are you punishing or not punishing? This is just what should happen, not what did happen.
I see. Okay.
Right? This is just, the concept is she's somebody who's so deeply rooted that she can infect the Jewish people then. But why should she be put to death? And I'm not sure of all the reasons, but just something that I could imagine would be that then she has pretty intimate knowledge of Jewish life, having been married to him for a while, especially in a time where it's not like today, when you are more part of the community, right? So then she might be more easily able to lead people astray in the future, pretending that she's Jewish, right? I actually have a friend today who's great-grandfather in Europe, great-grandfather, married a non-Jewish woman, had a baby, had a girl, wife dies, and then he married a Jewish woman and had the rest of his family. She, however, is descended from that first daughter, which makes her not Jewish. Even though her grandfather then married a Jew, had a Jewish family, All the other ones married Jews, including that girl who was raised in that Jewish home. She was raised Jewish. She got married to a Jew. She wasn't Jewish, and neither was her daughter, and neither is my friend today, even though she's
been Jewish forever. So is there a big process to convert in that instance?
Well, she would have to actually keep all the mitzvahs, right? So she's not. She's definitely very Jewishly identified and very Jewishly spiritual. But does she actually want to take on 100% of Shabbos or Shabbos occasionally? It's very nice, you know? So in order to convert, you actually have to say, yes, I'm going to keep all Shabbos all the time, and I'm going to keep kosher all the time. I'm not just going to not eat non-kosher meats in all the restaurants I go to, which is, I think, where she's holding these days. Like, she would have to say, I'm not going to go to any of those restaurants ever. Mm-hmm. So that's a big deal. Yeah. Right, so, but somebody like that could easily, as they did, easily marry a Jew and blend right in. No problem. So this person probably, I could see that might be a reason to say, if it's so dangerous, if this person is so dangerous, do you want them blending right in? Maybe you don't. Maybe that's why they have to be put to death. Is it a punishment or is it a protection? Did they really do that? I hope not. But, is that the concept? I could see that being a concept, that could be dangerous. Just like those converts who tried to fake out the West Side community, remember, like 15 years ago?
I remember that, right?
What?
Yeah.
A couple of kids of a messianic minister, so his kids being in their 20s, posed as converts to Judaism, moved to the West Side, did convert, I think, through West Side people, were totally hosted and beloved by families, plural, on the West Side. The Kollel made their second wedding for them. They birthed their next son. She's covering her hair. He's learning Gemara with the Kollel. And they're ready to make Aliyah. Rabbi Schwab is about to sign off on their papers. Rabbi Senior Schwab signed off on their papers to make Aliyah so they can go to Israel because they want to, you know, live that life. They're at the Shabbos table one day with a relatively new Baal Tshuva, or exploring Baal Tshuva, relatively new, who looks at them and says, "Aren't you the daughter of that messianic minister?" Because she had gone through that path, that Baal Tshuva. And they're like, "What do you mean? Who are you talking about?" And turns out, yes, they were posing the whole time just so they could learn what they needed to learn and get signed off so they could go to Israel to start converting people.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
It was really
the whole
weird.
Community
was huge,
tricked.
Huge.
And it like freaked out because it really was. Everybody was bought into it. It freaked out the West Side.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's why only.
Yeah. A long time.
That's why
the
only today.
Jewish news had a very,
they did.
Yeah.
I remember they had a big spread on it. Yeah.
If you want to read about it.
Yeah, and that's why only last year did they start
to.
Do
they know Jewish bad birth?
No.
But only last year did they start to consider doing conversions here in Denver after that. It took that long for people to, like, thaw.
Have confidence in them.
Yeah. Because otherwise, anybody who wanted to convert had to fly out to Chicago, Los Angeles, or New York, or Rabbi Levitt would fly in a rabbi from New York and do it here, but no Denver rabbis would do conversions. Because they're like, no. If that could happen and we could all be completely tricked, no, I'm not. I'm not touching it, not with the 10-foot pole. Yeah.
It was bad.
Yeah.
I can't imagine somebody in their heart having that. It's so beyond me.
How could you, as a human, how could they like live with themselves?
I can't.
They're
on a mission.
They felt like they were.
If
doing
you
the right
believe,
thing,
right?
They believe.
That's right.
They believe.
If you
believe
that every soul that's born into this world is destined for hell,
unless
they're saved.
Right.
And you care about humanity, then you would want to help save souls.
It's the power of ideology.
Oh, yeah.
There are many ideologies.
Yeah. So then you can just do it. The
yeah.
same
I mean,
thing.
They felt, I yeah. mean, they...
They're called to a mission, yeah. 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 Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep, okay.
For us to manage.
Yeah, it is hard. Okay, number 428, not to derive any benefit from any ornamentation of an idol. Okay. So this is, of course, we can't derive any benefit from an idol, right? So there, you see a totem pole that somebody made. You can't buy it. You can't look at it. You can't take a picture of it. You can't get any benefit from it. Okay, what about it's not a totem pole? Somebody made it, okay? An Asherah tree, a tree that grows that somebody designated as an idol tree, right? Okay, the tree you're not allowed to get any benefit from. But what if somebody covers it like it's a thing because this is gold territory. Everybody, like, there's somebody who sells gold leaf. And people can just hammer a little bit of gold leaf onto it as a devotional act, right? Which people do. They do that in India. Some of the idols in India, people buy a little bit of gold leaf, and that's their korban to the idols. They just tap it on, and that's how, like, some of those Buddhas stay gold, is people constantly are bringing gold and tapping it on, right?
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah. So let's just say, because the Buddha for sure not okay, and the gold leaf not okay, but this is a tree or a mountain. Native Americans have a mountain that they say is holy, right? And now they do something to cover the mountain in some spot with something. That thing isn't the Avodah Zarah thing, right? Whatever covered it, the gold leaf on the tree or the crystal cover of a spot on the mountain or something like that. That thing isn't worshipped. That's just covering the thing that was worshipped, right? Even that, you can't. So not to derive any benefit from any ornamentation of an idol. Even that's completely forbidden. No benefit at all whatsoever. You can't take that gold and melt it down and make it into wedding rings. Like, there's no, you're not allowed to use it. Can't get any benefit from it, of the ornamentation of it. Now, that's that one, basically. 429, not to take any object from idolatry into our possession to derive benefit from it. Okay, so this is, of course, we already said the idolatry and we already said the cover of it. What does this mean? So this is, there's three different things, right? So there's the Avodah Zarah itself. It's not talking about that. This is talking about things that are used to serve it or things that are brought to it. So let's use our gold leaf example, right? You need a little hammer to knock it onto the Buddha. How are you rubbing it on, or however that thing is, however that works, right? You can't use that hammer to break nuts now in your house. You can't take it into your house. That wasn't used to serve the Avodah Zarah, but it's a thing that was used to serve it, right? So you can't use that. There's no benefit from that. You can't bring it into your house, and you can't derive any benefit from it. This brings us to, or anything that was offered to it. So the gold, either, was offered to it. You can't use that. Right, you can't have a fruit salad out of the fruits that are used. Like sometimes you go into those Oriental, you know, stores, you need to buy a new rice cooker. That's the only place that sells the Zuzurusha. Now you can go on Amazon. But right, back in the day when you had to go in the stores, you see the little Buddha right there with his little fruits in front of him and the incense next to him, right? You wouldn't be able to go to that Korean person's house or whoever owns that store and they made a fruit salad and wonder, oh, were these fruits from that? Right, right. You can't eat that. You're not allowed to eat that. Huh. Or even smell it and say, wow, that smells great. You can't do that either. No benefit from it at all. Now let's go to something that happened a few years ago. What year was it? I wrote it down because I was listening. 1994. You may remember this. Indian hair in wigs.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So it turns out that hair, the Indian hair, was offered to idols. Right? So the women would grow their hair long, and as an idolatrous practice, they would go.
Current days?
Yeah. No. Mm-hmm. Now, really? Still today.
Oh, okay.
They grow their hair long, and then as a devotional act, they go into the temple, they lean their head or something like that towards the idol to show it, and then the priest cuts their hair as a devotional act, and it's whatever it is, placed, you know, before the idol or something like that, whatever. It's a part of the idol worship. Mm-hmm. And then, in order to support the priests and the food
they
and
sell the hair.
They take the hair and they sell it, and it's made into wigs. Right. Okay. So that hair,
yeah.
That hair in a wig makes the wig completely forbidden, right? You can't even have any benefit from it at all. So you can't sell it. You can't stop wearing it. You can't give it to a cancer patient. You can't use it at all. No benefit at all whatsoever, right? So you can't wear it. So now it's completely lost, right? So what did they do? They burned them, right? They had bonfires in Israel where people brought their Indian hair wigs and they burned them because it has to be destroyed.
I remember that.
So, and now, today, wigs, and who knows if it's true, and who knows who's really watching, and you, how can, I mean, like, you can't, each person can't go as far as they would like to go to find out, but, so, Indian hair is not allowed in wigs, so now today's wigs have a little hechsher on them that say no Indian hair. Now, we know that people lie like rugs, and not all wigs are made by honest Jews, and many are made in China, and you don't know where the hair is coming from. So basically, European hair is kosher hair, and Indian hair is not kosher hair, and Chinese hair. So those are the three hairs that are used in wigs.
And what about Chinese hair?
Chinese hair is permitted. So
they don't use their hair in idol worship.
Right. So you have these three types of hair. Now, Chinese hair is coarser. It's straight, but it's coarse. So that's the less good human hair wig. So people don't
use them. That's
not really bought yet, if you can afford. Right. In European hair, it doesn't mean it comes from Europe. It means it comes from a European head. Right, so it's one of our heads in this room. It's European hair, it's thinner, it's lighter, it has more of a swing and a shine, right? But close to that is Indian hair. That is in between Chinese hair and European hair. It's thinner than Chinese hair, has more of a swing and a shine, but thicker than European hair. It's not quite as flexible or as bouncy, right? So European hair, top of the line. Indian hair, if you treat it with chemicals, looks like European hair, at least at first. So a lot of wigs, lower-end wigs, you know, let's say the $1,000 wigs, lower-end, or the $500 to $1,000 human hair wigs, those would be made with Indian hair, treated so that it looks better. It's the $1,500 wigs or the, you know, 1,000 ups, depending on where you're getting it from, the wholesale or whatever, but those are made with the European hair. So people are on a budget. They rather get the less, you know, a pretty wig that's less expensive, so that's where you're getting into the Indian hair question mark zone. So you're not allowed to have Indian hair, so that's why they all have these hechshers that say no Indian hair was used in this, but who knows? Who knows, really? We don't know. Anyway, that's this isser. That's the point. That is an example of this particular isser, this particular prohibition, not to take any object from idolatry into our possession to derive benefit from it. You can't bring it into your house. You can't get any benefit from it. So both, you can't bring it into your house and you can't get benefit from it. So you can't get benefit from it. That means you can't wear it as your wig, right? Can't bring it into your house. Now, I happen to be related to somebody who's fabulous, but somebody, that fabulous person, also loves Kuan Yin, the Chinese goddess of compassion, as if there could be such thing, whatever. Loves
Kuan Yin? That's
Kuan Yin. Kuan Yin.
It's a god.
That's her name.
Goddess. Goddess, okay.
So one day, this relative is visiting me and they're so excited to be near Manhattan, where there's so many places to buy Kuan Yins in Manhattan. Who knew? So into Manhattan they go, and they're so excited, and I say to them,
can't bring it to my house.
I don't think you can bring it into my house. Like, it's really a problem. I can't have that in my house. What am I going to do? Mm-hmm. I don't know what to do. Can I sell you a room in my house? Like, maybe I was thinking Pesach, right?
Maybe,
like, maybe it's not my house. Outside's still my property. What do you do? What do you do? And so they wisely said, why don't you call your rabbi and ask? Good idea. So I called my rabbi at that time. It was Moshe Dov Stein, Alav Shalom. He's the Rosh Kol and Posek of Shar Yashuv Yeshiva. And he was so wise. He listened to my whole thing. What should I do? Should I sell a room? Should I be outside? And they're not going home for a few days. And what can we do? And
ship it.
And he said, it's not your business what your guest purchases. Don't ask them.
Good answer. Wow. Good answer.
And so when they called me and said, what did your rabbi say? That's right.
I said,
he told me it's not my business what you buy and I shouldn't ask you. And they said, okay.
And they didn't and you didn't.
Right, right.
Because Eliza, that brings up an interesting problem for merchants. And that is, we merchants cannot control, I mean, we Jewish merchants can't control the activities that our customers use those things that we sell.
That's correct, and we do not have to say.
Right. You may buy this hammer if you promise not.
No. So that's not our job. That is not our job at all. Mm-hmm. However, we do have a concept, and we don't have to worry about it in this country because not a country of Avodah Zarah. But if we lived in India, we would have to worry about this. That 3 days before a holiday, we're not supposed to do business with idol worshippers because they might be coming into our store to buy something for their holiday. Mm-hmm. So we don't. So that is, yeah, you just close your store. You're not allowed to do business with them. So you don't want them buying that hammer because you don't know what they're using it for, or a knife to shecht their whatever it is, right? You know, so you don't, 3 days before, you just close your store. So that's the rule of the Rambam. And I don't know exactly how that works. It, really, if you're a merchant in one of those countries, so then, yeah, go figure, you'll have to ask your own shilas. But that's what the Rambam says. And the Rambam lived, he really lived in Muslim lands, so it's interesting.
So
he lived in the land where there's a prohibition to live.
Yes, he did. He also.
And I'd like to know how.
Right, how that worked. Right. I can't remember. It's the Rambam. I think it is the Rambam who signed his letters. Is it the Rambam or some other big gadol? Signed his letters instead of saying, you know, sincerely, truly yours, the Rambam. He wrote, Ha'over al shlosha lavim, the Rambam, the transgressor of three prohibitions.
How fascinating.
Yeah. And those three prohibitions, one was living in Egypt, one was not living in the land of Israel. And I forgot what the other one was. Wow. But that's how he signed them. Just everybody should know, this is who I am. I'm a transgressor. Yeah. So that's how he signed the letters. Ha'over al shlosha lavim. Let's just put this out there. Everybody should know that I am a violator of halacha. And
even though he was the preeminent halacha.
Right. Yeah. So he knew that was it was a problem. How did he live? I mean, so those are questions, and that would be fascinating. I just don't know enough about the. I know that he grappled with that, and I know that he also, like, his doctorship of the Sultan wasn't really voluntary. I mean, he had to. It's not what he wanted to do. So I don't think
he was commanded to be.
I don't think he could have left so easily. I mean, he probably could have picked up his whole family, and he certainly didn't have to go there. He did go there in the first place. But did he have to go there? It's not a world like it is today. And even today, there's not.
He also was expelled.
Right.
I mean, he was not voluntarily going.
That's what I'm saying. So even today, there's not so many options. I mean, like, so we, Baruch Hashem, live in the United States where we have tons of options. We are so comfortable. And we cannot understand what it's like to be stateless and not to be able to go places where people say, no, you can't come here. No, you can't come here. No, you can't come here.
You can't leave the country that you're in.
Right.
We've taken away your passport and you can't leave.
Right.
There's nowhere you can.
Right.
So not only can't you leave, there's nowhere you can go in because you don't have the proper papers.
You can't get out and nobody will take you in.
Right.
So you figure it out for yourself, right? So
you're stuck.
That is kind of how he lived. That is how he lived, you know, was like that. So we can't, it's so hard for us as Americans with so much privilege. You know, and that's why I celebrate Thanksgiving. So there's all this controversy. Do you, don't you? If you're from, should you, shouldn't you? I'm like, I am so thankful to live in this country.
Now, why shouldn't you?
Why shouldn't you?
What's the argument that you shouldn't?
Because it's a Gaisha holiday. It's not a religious holiday.
But it's not a religious holiday.
It's not a it is a religious holiday.
It's not like Christmas, though.
It's a religious holiday, but not of a religion.
Okay.
So you could be permitted, but some people would say, well, Thanksgiving every day. Same reason you shouldn't celebrate Mother's Day. Like, every day you should respect and honor your mother. Yes, you should.
Yes.
But so, and every day we Jews daven and say thank you to Hashem. Right. We have Shabbos every week. So you shouldn't, because it's not our thing. So a lot of people don't. A lot of the frummies do not celebrate, and they don't celebrate Thanksgiving. Part of it's not adding. You shouldn't imitate the non-Jews. You shouldn't do like the non-Jews. So the non-Jews do that. We don't do that. We don't do what they do. It seems that we're kind of selective in that.
In what she said they don't like to fun, so it's...
Right. No, so actually one of the reasons is because it actually takes away from the kavod of Shabbos, from the honoring of that Shabbos. Because you just made a huge meal. Mm-hmm. How much energy do you have to do with the whole thing again? And will you chas v'sholem serve leftovers for Shabbos? You know, and not make it all fresh? You might be tempted, right? So... We don't serve leftovers, but we like the Thanksgiving food so much that we sometimes want to eat it again the next day because it's so yummy.
I was going to say, it is
who
so
can get enough cranberry sauce and stuffing, really?
Right. So, yes, I'm with you.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I make fresh, but I also make, you know, we also enjoy some foods again. That's not serving leftovers. It's serving what we want. Okay, that being said, I guess we don't really have time for 4:36, which I was going to skip. But let's just quickly... The precept to destroy an idol and all that serves it. So that's just all part of this. This is 4:36. Let's see, where is that? I probably marked the page. Yes, I did. It's page 357. So that is, I mean, continuing with Avodah Zarah and how negative it is and how it pulls us away from everything that we're supposed to be accomplishing in this world. So that we can't marry with it, so that we can't get any benefit from it, so that we can't have any of it. Oh, and 4:29 even would be included not bringing yayin nesach into your home. So if they're not even bringing wine that was, that is, so there's two types of wine that aren't kosher. There's yayin nesach and yayin stam yayinim. So yayin nesach is wine that you, that might have been or definitely was, libation was poured from it for idolatrous purposes. So, and that might even include wines made in, like they used to be made in convents and nunneries, you know, and they would pour some off even if it would be.
Cask, you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's Yayin Nesach, and that's completely forbidden in any type of a way. And some people would say any non-kosher wine also is a problem, but it's not, wouldn't be considered maybe Aser Bahana'a, that you can't get any benefit from it, just that you can't consume it. So you might be able to, but some people hold not. You might be able to pass along a bottle to somebody. If somebody gives you a gift of non-kosher wine that's not Yayin Nesach, that you could pass it. Some people say yes, and some people say no. For sure, if it's Yayin Nesach, you can't. You have to just destroy the bottle and pour out the wine. Anyway, but this is just, so we just understand the depth of, you can't have anything, not anything that's connected to Avodah Zarah at all. It's the opposite purpose for the reason why the whole world is here. The whole world is here is to proclaim God's oneness. That's it. In life and in death, whether you're Chaya Levine, who lost her husband and says Hashem is one no matter what, you know, or you're in business and, you know, somebody offers you cash, no tax, you have to say no. Actually, I live in a country where the tax is fair. And that's the laws. We pay tax. So I pay tax because Hashem is one. I'm not going to spend money on Shabbos food with the untaxed money where I didn't pay the government fairly. Like that's, I can't do that. Right? And that itself is considered an Avodah Zarah if you worship the dollar more than you worship Hashem, that you're not willing to be honest with your money or your possessions or those kinds of things. So that all has to be destroyed, and the root has to be destroyed. Anything that you can destroy of idol worship has to be destroyed. Can we today walk into a Beit Avodah Zarah? We see some temple. Do we have to become arsonists? We do not. Right? So that's not the halacha, that in a country where it's illegal to do that, as this one, that you have to go burning down something like that. However, let's say you run a junk store, right? And you get stuff from people's estates or whatever, and somebody brings you over crates and crates of stuff, and among it is one of the things. No, you can't sell it, and no, you can't have it, and no, you can't bring it in. You need to destroy it. It has to be destroyed. So you get that totem pole, you have to burn it. You know, you can't even just throw it in the dumpster that somebody could dumpster dive. You have to destroy it. That's your job. If you can, that's the halacha. You have to destroy anything that has to do with idol worship. If you can, if it's permitted in the place that you live, and you won't be in danger from doing it. So I wonder what it would be like. I don't know if there's nobody like. I'm trying to think if there's another. We're not halachically required to destroy a Quran, but let's say there was another document that was an Avodah Zarah document, that there would be violent reactions, as if you destroyed a Quran. Would you be permitted to destroy it or not? I don't know if you have to put your life in jeopardy to do that. I'm just saying.
Or
I'm just making a theoretical thing.
Or potentially put the lives of others.
Right. I don't think you have to do that.
You would think not.
I would think not. But if you don't, you know, so then, yeah, you have to destroy whatever comes into your possession, your ability, or if it's hefker, even if you see it walking down the street, it belongs to no one. You're not supposed to just pass it by. You have to destroy it so that somebody else shouldn't pick it up.
Are you in your mother's home at any given time where there might be a manger set up?
Yeah, so then I'm not permitted to destroy it because it's not mine. But if I would inherit it, then I would have to.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what, I mean, and is that a Avodah Zarah? I'd have to ask a Shaila on that. Is that a Avodah Zarah?
To destroy the idol?
No, is a creche scene Avodah Zarah. Because we don't hold that Christianity is Avodah Zarah. Right. Nevertheless, a creche scene with a little idol.
Do
they worship it? Don't they worship it? So I think it would make it, I think it would
it
be
a question.
I think it would be a question depending on Catholic, Protestant, religious, not religious. Who held what about it? Was it just decoration? Was it actually rooted in? I think those are all halachic questions. You know, because somebody...
And probably the answer to various ones of those would affect the answer.
I think so, because some Mary statues that would be sold in a gardening store might not be
probably
considered
not.
Idols until a Catholic buys them.
And then they might.
And it depends on that Catholic. The Catholic that really cares, that lights candles in front of it every day, that prays to Mary, that's probably an idol that needs to be destroyed.
Right.
You know, so where it's in the gardening
store. If it were to come into your possession.
Right. Right, so then it depends. Intent makes a huge difference in all these things. Mm-hmm. So we should be zecha to root out the idolatry in our lives and just serve the one Hashem alone without any adulterating forces anywhere.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
I hope you have your choir.